This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey.
Whenever I chance to meet some old friends on the street, they wonder how does a man get to be this way. I've always got a smiling face, anytime and any place. And every time they ask me why, I just smile and say, you've got to kiss an angel good morning and let her know you think about her when you're gone.
This is the great Charlie Pride, for a long time regarded as the biggest black artist in country music. And for a lot of fans, I would guess he was the only black artist they knew of in country music. But as my guest today will tell us, that overlooks a long black history in the genre, a history and a future that is still being written today. Francesco Royster is the author of the new book, Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. In the introduction, she writes about attending a country music festival in Chicago some years back and says, "Why is it that listening to country music is so loaded for many black listeners like me? Country music performance spaces, such as bars, concerts, festivals like this one, and even the internet, can be places of community and alliance across racial lines. But they also can evoke and memorialize visceral memories of racialized violence, lynchings, the indignities of Jim Crow, gender surveillance and disciplining, and the continued existence of racial segregation in urban, suburban, and rural spaces in the North and South. In these ways, loving country music is ambiguous, amorphous, risky, and sometimes lonely for many of its performers and listeners." Francesco Royster is a professor of English at DePaul University in Chicago. She joins me now. Francesco, welcome to The 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Hi.
Hi there. And I want to also invite listeners to join our conversation as ever at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. So I want to begin with just the genre of country music. How did that come to be? Where did it come from?
Well, sure. Well, people have been making what's sometimes called old time or roots music, you know, for a long time. And among the roots are like the string band music that was originated with African-American banjo playing, some of the music of minstrel shows and coon shows, and mountain music as well. So really country music, you know, at its foundation is multiple and a Creole American music. That's what Rhiannon Giddens calls it. But in the 1920s, when record executives realized that that there was a market for this music that had been going on, this folk music that had been going on all along, there was this decision to segregate two different kinds of music that were sometimes intertwined: race music, which included the blues and country blues, and burgeoning jazz, and hillbilly music in the 1920s. And so people like Ralph Peer, who was a music executive and talent scout, kind of helped cultivate this idea of hillbilly music as its own marketable brand, with, you know, people like Fiddlin' John Carson, these personalities who could represent country. And, you know, into the 50s and onward, there's been sort of a name change for country, from country, from hillbilly to country and western, to just country music. And part of that is acknowledging the ways that hillbilly as a name is, you know, stereotypical and insulting for some people, especially kind of thinking about migrations of people coming from the South to the North. So there was kind of this desire to create an image of country music that could be both nostalgic for the people coming from the South into the North, but also a place to reflect images of the South as the South was changing, you know, into the mid and late 20th century.
And I like that you called out or drew out these two strands, right, of the black tradition of country music, this sort of the everyday music of black folks pre and post emancipation. You imagine that's potentially seen as empowering today. But there's also this these roots in blackface minstrelsy, right? This thing that you say in the book sends people screaming from the room when they try to understand and consume some of this work. I wonder, is it possible to understand the history of American popular music today without reckoning with that history of blackface minstrelsy?
I really think that blackface is so vital. It's vital to understanding popular music and the ways that, you know, marketing happens, the kind of traditions of performance, comedy and humor in the United States, theater as well. So not only is it true that, you know, this earlier music was kind of the way to make money for musicians, black and white, and, you know, people like Gus Cannon, who was an African-American medicine show performer, also had to perform in blackface, you know, as well as white performers as well, like Dan Emmett and others. So, so blackface is really important for that early history. And it's also important for the ways that country music developed, because it really became a way of evoking an older South. So on shows like the Grand Ole Opry, when it was a radio show, and the National Barn Dance, there were still performers who, for their comedy sessions, would use blackface. So I think that it's really a part of who we are as a culture, you know, in the United States. And it's also one of the reasons that I think country music has become an uncomfortable genre for at least some African Americans. And, you know, I just feel like it's like a history that haunts the music. And, you know, it can be felt underneath the surface, even if you don't know that that's part of what is the roots of country.
Yeah, no, felt under the surface. I like how you said that, because you mentioned that it was on these TV or radio programs, I guess, through the 50s, even, which is certainly living memory for a lot of people. And then you even like the was it Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Sweet Home Alabama, you have that, you do that sort of close reading of some of the words, and there's that reference to Alabama in that song, which sort of evokes that Al Jolson kind of style. How is it then, if it's, I mean, you correctly identified as an uncomfortable space, how did you come to be interested in this?
Well, one of the things that influenced me was that I was talking to my father, who's a musician as well as an English teacher. And when we lived in Nashville during my childhood, he would play as a sessions musician on different albums that were being produced in the 1970s, including some country music albums. And so just talking to him, it really made me realize how, for the most part, Black participation in country music felt invisible to me. And I felt that kind of haunted feeling about it, even though, you know, as someone who's, you know, studied popular entertainment, I knew that we were there in the history. I just still felt like all these question marks about it. So talking to my dad made me think about that more. And then at the same time, I discovered Tina Turner's first solo album, which was a country album, Tina Turns the Country On. And I love Tina Turner. I love already too, the way that in her sound, you can hear the Southern and country roots, even in her rock songs. And just to hear her embrace country music as a way to kind of explore her own emotional life and emotional change, I thought was really exciting. And so that then led me to think about my own memories of growing up in Nashville and also interview Black country music fans to hear what their experiences were as well. And that got me on my road to writing the book.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Francesca Royster, who is the author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. She's also a professor of English at DePaul University in Chicago. And I want to come back a little later to your own personal journey, and including banjo lessons, which I think is fascinating. And some people may learn some stuff about the history of the banjo in our conversation a little later. But let's talk about Charlie Pride. I began the segment with it. I think it's, I said this before, if you ask people of a certain age to name a black country music singer, Charlie Pride would probably be the alpha and the omega of their list. So tell us a little bit about who was Charlie Pride.
Absolutely. So Charlie Pride, I believe, grew up in the West, in Montana, but decided after a career of being a semi-professional baseball player that he really wanted to make a career in country music and came to Nashville. He, after a lot of kind of convincing people, was able to sign eventually with RCA in 1965, and he became one of RCA's biggest selling artists, second only to Elvis in the 1970s. And he was someone who was able to negotiate some of the awkwardness of country music, live performance especially, playing to mostly white audiences. And I think it was awkward or uncomfortable or even dangerous because this was also, you know, at the rise of the civil rights movement, there's a lot of racial tension in the country. And Pride was able to produce this wonderful music and also perform, you know, as a black man, kind of acknowledging that. And, you know, in some ways had, in many ways had a stellar career. But what I found too, you know, in reading interviews with him and especially his memoir, Pride, the Charlie Pride story, which he wrote in the 1990s, he also expresses, you know, negotiating these pressures, negotiating, you know, threats to his life, sometimes also not being taken seriously by other country music artists, or just having to navigate racism, you know, throughout. Sometimes their shows were canceled due to bomb threats. And part of the way that he really was able to make his mark was through collaborations. And one of his most famous collaborations was with Willie Nelson, who went on tour with him down south, you know, in the late 1960s. And, you know, they really had to deal with a lot of tension, a lot of, you know, also threats to their lives at different points. Some of their shows were canceled. But I think that series of concerts really kind of got Pride, you know, on the road to developing a career, and really was able to do something that a lot of artists that were who were African American, who were trying to break into country music, weren't quite able to do. Because you can think about Bobby Womack or Joe Simon or Lindo Martell, you know, these other African American country music artists who were trying to make a place in the genre at the same time, who had a lot of trouble getting purchase on what they were doing, getting the approval of their labels, and just finding an audience. So, so I think Pride had a really impressive career and influenced a lot of country music artists afterwards, especially Darius Rucker, who really cites him as a central influence for him, even as he was navigating similar tensions, you know, in the 1990s and 2000s.
Absolutely. I in preparing for this segment, I actually realized that I actually interviewed Darius Rucker back in 2010. I was a newspaper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was a newspaper reporter. He was going to be performing at the Illinois State Fair. You know, we did talk about Charlie Pride, as I'm sure he did in, you know, 100 forgettable interviews that year with newspaper reporters across the country. But, I mean, it's so interesting, right? Because he really downplayed at the time. And I think he's reckoned with it a little more recently, but he downplayed any sort of, you know, tension, what would you say, with the largely white audiences and that undercurrent of hostility that could be there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, as a kid growing up, you know, in the 70s when Charlie Pride was making his career, I, you know, had no idea that this was something that he was dealing with. And he really, it's really later part of life toward the end of his career that he publicly talked about some of those tensions. And instead, he really approached things in a good humored way. Even in his memoir, he uses a lot of humor as a way of talking about how he lived through some of the more difficult parts of his career, and just kind of focused instead on on the successes that he was able to have, like, being a semi-regular on Hee Haw, or, representing country music, for different award shows, and really being a very public country music star. I think, he talked about going on stage when he first started and making a joke about apologizing for his permanent tan to his audience. And I think that kind of humor of, just kind of making light of the visual aspect of his presence as a Black person was one of the ways that he strategized and kind of lived with things. And I think he also had a very, he really leaned hard on his marriage with his wife, and just was also, someone who gathered friends and supporters and kind of, kept a circle of people around him to get through things.
Yeah. All right. We need to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation with Francesca Royster, author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. And we've been talking about Charlie Pride and his connection to Darius Rucker, formerly of Hootie and the Blowfish, but he's had a substantial country career on his own for the past couple of decades now. And let's go out into the break with a song from Darius Rucker. This is called Beers and Sunshine.
Sit around and play. Gonna hit balls off the dock, kick back in my flip-flops. Don't owe nothing to the lender, nothing spinning in the blender. The only thing on my agenda is beers and sunshine, bonfires in summertime, back porch nights in South Carolina. Ain't nothing finer than me and my girls striking up a little. Turn on the good times, turn off the TV. Yeah, the only BS I need is beers and sunshine. Gonna call my girl and say,
this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our conversation with Francesca Royster, author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. We're going to start with another clip. This is from the Country Music Awards in 2016. This is, again, Beyoncé and the band formerly known as the Dixie Chicks, now just known as the Chicks. But at the time, as we heard on the clip, they were the Dixie Chicks. Francesca Royster, what did you think of that performance when you first saw it?
I thought it was fantastic. Just in terms of the kind of virtuoso kind of parts of these divas performing on this stage, like the give and take between Beyoncé and the Chicks, their energy, the ability to involve the audience. It really also, like, the other performers, the other instrumentalists, just looked like they're having a great time. And I thought that, at the time, I just thought, wow, what an accomplishment. Like, she's just taking the stage by storm. And then, later, as I started really finding out what was happening, I've discovered that what I was watching as this welcoming, exciting backyard barbecue kind of performance was actually quite controversial. And especially from country fans who disapproved of Beyoncé, both for her music and for her politics, and of the Chicks. This was actually the first time that they had returned to the CMAs since they had been more or less blacklisted from this award show and from country radio. And so they were kind of making their premiere together. So there was a lot of tension, surrounding the performance. But I think it was also one of the moments that is, to me, marking a moment that we're in right now, where more African-American artists are claiming country music as, you know, at least part of their repertoire, getting out in public, showing up on shows like the CMAs. So I really also see it as a kind of important moment to begin a new movement.
Yeah, and you talk a little bit about the outlaw tradition in country music. How does Beyoncé fit into that? So I don't know that that's intuitive for everybody.
Sure. Well, I definitely think that Beyoncé is an outlaw, especially, you know, in terms of her ability to use her celebrity to talk about social injustice, to speak out as a Black feminist. But I think that there's also a way that in this song in particular, she's kind of taking some of the country music tropes of the father who's sort of outside of the law, tough but tender, you know, that might show up in traditional country music of the late 1960s and 1970s of the outlaw movement. So, you know, really thinking about, you know, Beyoncé as kind of a Johnny Cash figure, but taking things, really speaking to her own audience. And in some ways also, you know, questioning some of the lessons of self-defense in terms of that are presented in the song, and to what extent Black men and Black people are encouraged to defend themselves in the way that a country music outlaw might be able to do, just given that. But so I really see her as an outlaw that way, and in terms of kind of taking these traditional ideas about toughness and about self-defense and claiming them for herself, but also kind of trying to think through what that can mean in terms of Black men and women's relationships with each other. So she's also kind of looking at the community and thinking about where do we go, you know, in terms of our own histories of violence and how that's affected our relationships.
I like how you said this is, you know, possibly where the genre could be going into the future. And that brings us to another group that you write about called Our Native Daughters, which is a super group of four Black female banjo players, on this album at least, who made the album Songs of Our Native Daughters. Let's listen to some of their song. This is called Black Myself. So little time to listen to music in our conversation today, about 9 minutes left. But what do you hear there?
Oh, you chose a great one. I love this song. So this song, Black Myself, was written by Amethyst Kia, who is one of Our Native Daughters, and they all performed it together. And in the lyrics, and even in the delivery of lyrics, you really hear this, you know, strong claiming of country music, country sound. You can hear the banjo underneath, you know, the voices. And Rhiannon Giddens was playing a minstrel banjo, or a reproduction of a minstrel banjo from the 19th century, on the album. And so at the same time that historical kind of stuff is happening in the song, it's also just a song about taking up space, about Black pride, about also queerness, which, you know, Kia is one of the few out Black queer writers, and musicians, and she, you know, has this line about, "I'm going to sweep that girl off of her feet." So she brings together, you know, all of our identities in this song, and the way that the call and the response of that song is structured, with the other women supporting her, and that I think is really powerful too.
So we can talk here as well a little bit about, you mentioned the banjo is being so core to what that album was about, and you yourself have had a banjo journey in recent years. Can you talk about, I'm reminded of that internet meme, how it started, how it's going, about your journey with the instrument, why you decided to take it up, and what it's been like learning about it and learning to play it?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I have to thank the Old Town School of Music, which is a wonderful center of folk music and culture here in Chicago, where I live, because they really make music lessons accessible, especially to adults who might not be especially good musicians like myself. So, I really recognized that the banjo is so key to the history that I wanted to uncover the kind of pre-marketing of country music, the roots of the sound and Black participation. So scholars have kind of discovered that the banjo was an African instrument, at least in its roots, and that enslaved people made their own banjos before emancipation and entertained themselves. And, the banjo was also a way of, of entertaining other people as well. Sometimes their masters, they would also play for them. So it has this history. It's really central to the minstrel tradition as well. And it becomes this kind of sonic marker of authentic country music, you know, in the 20th century. And so when I was growing up, the banjo really didn't seem like it was an instrument that reflected Black culture. And I was completely wrong. So I thought, okay, I really want to learn the banjo. I want to get comfortable with it. I want to understand what's beautiful about it. And so I started taking some classes. And at the Old Town, there was also a chance to take a seminar with Sully Gregg Wilson, who was a founding member of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and who was did a seminar on the African roots of the banjo. So I did this workshop, and because my banjo skills were pretty limited, I was especially excited about just learning the history, but also really taking my hand at learning by ear and really understanding the instrument that way. So I think learning the banjo and kind of having it around and picking it up to play helps me as a writer kind of talk about the music, talk about the spirit of the music, and also just feel like the music belongs to me too.
All right, we've only got about 4 minutes, maybe even 3 minutes remaining, which is not enough time, but we need to talk a little bit about Lil Nas X and his mega hit Old Town Road. And we can go out with that music at the end of our show today, so I'm not going to play it now. But I didn't realize that song was only on the country charts for 1 week. Can you talk about that and what that says about the future and the possible convergences of Black people and country music in our future?
Yes, I would love to. Old Town Road is so interesting and quirky because for Lil Nas X, I think it was an experiment with the sound. You know, he's a musician who grew up in Atlanta and, you know, definitely, you know, has access and the right to country music as much as anyone. But I think he was also kind of interested in the cowboy as a kind of image of freedom, personal freedom for himself. As a young man who's sort of finding his way. And one of the things that's really spectacular about this song is also the way that Lil Nas X was able to make use of technology to make the song, you know, by buying a sample on YouTube and distribute the song despite the gatekeepers of, you know, of country radio, really through social media, like sites like Reddit, Instagram. He was able to get Billy Ray Cyrus to collaborate with him on at least one of the versions of the song, really through his social media and kind of asking his Hive to help him get connected to Billy Ray Cyrus. So so Lil Nas X, to me, kind of takes the genius of the millennial generation of really being able, really knowing their way inside and out, to create this song that surpasses the limits of genre. I think it's really a funny song, I think, and really very creative, to create this song that then ended up shaking up country music, radio, and marketing. It was on, you know, on the Billboard charts as a country music song, partly based on its listenership, but then, you know, was contested because of what was called its lack of country music elements. And some of that, I think, is kind of a critique of the use of trap drums that are associated with hip hop in the song as well. But rather than letting that stop him, I think he just kept making more and more versions. Yeah. And, you know, and eventually made this album Montero, which continues to rattle people and get people excited and to build in new fans. So,
I mean, he's riding on a horse. He's riding on a tractor. I don't know how people can say it's not country.
Yeah, it seems like it to me. Yeah. And has yodeling, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We will listen to that on our way out. Francesco Royster is the author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. It was really a fun read. You can check it out. We'll have a link to it at our website. Francesco Royster, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you so much, Brian. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And that is it for our program today. I'm not going to do long credits, so we have a little more time for Lil Nas X. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow. Cheated on my baby. You can go and ask me. My life is a movie.